Who was Mahsa Amini, the young woman who has inspired protests around the world?
Iran's morality police arrested Amini for what they described as immodest attire. 3 days later, in their custody, she was dead.
Plus a look at the significance of the protests against Iran's leadership.
So it's a very old fight. The anger is very deep. Earlier generations of women protested against it.
And later in the program, the story of a dancer who fled the country for fear of being jailed.
A neighbor had even reported her to the police. They accused her of being a prostitute. I had to make a choice, she says, between dancing or living in Iran.
From the Voice of America, this is a special presentation of Flashpoint Iran. Good morning. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, filling in for Michael Lippin. Around the world, streets have been filled with protesters since the death of Mahsa Amini. VOA's Arash Arabasadi has more on the young woman who brought about a wave of global protests who are chanting, "Women, life, freedom."
It's been several weeks of sometimes violent street demonstrations in Iran. Dozens of protesters have died. Some have killed security forces. This all started when 22-year-old Mahsa Amini, a college student with her eyes set on higher education, became the face of a global movement for human rights. Iran's morality police arrested Amini for what they described as immodest attire. 3 days later, in their custody, she was dead. The Islamic Republic released a video it says comes from a police station showing Amini falling to the ground. Officials say the fall triggered a fatal heart attack. Her family says Amini had no known history of heart troubles. That's when protests began, at first without the Islamic Republic crushing them as they have previous demonstrations. More recently, however, Iran resumed its violent suppression of its own people and demonstrations have turned bloody.
دختر جوانی درگذشت خب حادثه تلخی بود دل ما هم سوخت
Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei called Amini's death a sad incident and said he was heartbroken, but he quickly shifted blame for unrest onto usual foils, the United States and Israel.
We're alarmed and appalled by reports.
The Biden administration says it's alarmed and appalled at what it sees as overreaction by security forces clashing with mostly unarmed protesters. Joining her family, Amini's supporters refute the official cause of death, saying Iran's morality police are to blame. And many Iranians say her death was the spark that lit outraged cries for change. Amini's family, in the meantime, today has more questions than they do answers. Here's her father, Amjad Amini, in an interview with VOA Persian shortly after her death. He says, the authorities never told us the result of the autopsy. They wrote a report the way they wanted it to be. The authorities promised to do a full investigation, but I swear to God that I do not believe a single word they say. I do not trust them at all, and I'm sure they are lying. Whatever they do or say won't bring back my girl to us. Some of the girls who were arrested alongside her told us that Mahsa received a blow to the head with a bat. It is a lie. I swear to God that she did not have any preconditions. Amjad Amini also said his only request is that his daughter's life not be forgotten. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
VOA Encounter host Carol Castiel recently spoke with foreign policy journalist Laura Rosen and director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute, Alex Vatanka, in October about the protests and their wider ramifications.
Alex Vatanka, let me begin with you. Protests started with the death of Mahsa Amini in custody. She was detained for improperly wearing a hijab, showing too much hair. And now we're seeing, over the past weeks, videos of women burning their hijabs, cutting their hair. Demonstrators in the street are chanting death to the dictator. Very bold. How serious do you believe this moment is in terms of the regime's authority and control?
Carol, let me just remind everyone that the Islamic Republic, this very militant Islamist system, has been in power in Iran since February of 1979, when Ayatollah Khomeini returned from exile and created this system. exactly a month into this new regime's life, March of 1979, the Islamists faced the first major street-level protest, and that was led by women on the issue of mandatory hijab, which was a new phenomenon. You've never had a law called mandatory hijab, the veiling of women by force. Khomeini and the Islamists that took over decided this is what they wanted to do. But my point is, let's not forget that Iranian women have been waging this fight for as long as the Islamic Republic has been around. So it's a very old fight. The anger is very deep. Earlier generations of women protested against it, but suppression by the regime forced people to essentially go home. But every time they went home, they were reminded how much they detested this law and they would come out. So you've had anger against this mandatory hijab, as I said, for as long as the Islamic Republic has been around. What's different this time around, it seems to me, is this new generation of Iranian, particularly Iranian women. But let's not forget, these Iranian women are backed up by Iranian men in this quest to get rid of this, not just the hijab. Essentially, what they want is the abolishment of a regime that very clearly a tiny minority, about 15% of Iranians, have any regard for the Islamic Republic. So this younger generation of Iranians, and the data speaks for itself, and I'm just going to give you some data from the Iranian regime itself. So this is not data from me or anyone outside of Iran. These are figures that the regime produces. Most of the people who are protesting right now are in the age of 15 to 25 group. This is a generation that not only dislikes the mandatory hijab or all sorts of other rules that the regime imposes on society, but it's a generation that is willing to fight for it. And that's the difference. This is a radical, if you will, generation. And that has caught the regime by surprise. And frankly, as we speak right now, the authorities in Iran have no idea what to do with this regime. They are pretty sure that this anger is not going to go anywhere. And if they suppress the protesters today, they're going to come back again next week, next month, next year. They don't have a solution, because if they start actually having compromises with the people who are protesting right now, it would be very evident to anyone who watches Iran that the system would have to go, because that's basically what the protest is about. It's not about the hijab per se. It's one issue that people care about. But the list of grievances against the regime is very long. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader at the top, knows that. And that's why he's so reluctant to start that dialogue with his own people.
Alex Vatanka, thank you for that terrific historical perspective. Now, turning to Laura Rosen. Laura, we're seeing a through line with women at the forefront protesting against the mandatory hijab. And yet, we have a new generation, younger women, more radicalized, a new generation backed up by men. How do you see this particular moment? And do you agree with Alex that the regime really is somewhat caught by surprise, is not really sure, you know, how to deal with this much more radicalized movement and the hijab really symbolizing many other grievances against the regime?
Yeah, I mean, Alex's historical perspective and his take on the recent last month of just stunning protests was incredibly helpful. I was in New York, I guess it was only a month ago, when the protests had only been going for a few days and the Iranian delegation was there. And at that time, Raisi was trying to sort of put out this line of like, Mahsa Amini's death is very sad and we're doing an investigation and we're little by little releasing results. So far, the preliminary results are that there's no sign that she was beaten. Maybe she had some condition. You know, they were trying to sort of test out this thing of, we'll acknowledge her death was sad, but we'll try to do a kind of controlled release to see if they could diffuse the protests and meantime, you know, crack down. And it just hasn't worked. You've seen them say that, you know, her death didn't come from beating. Now we've seen other teenagers, you know, tragic videos of these compelling teenagers on their video blogs talking about their lives, their dreams, and their parents saying that the authorities have dishonestly alleged that they felt to their death. And then you'll see other videos of them being beaten. So no one believes what the authorities are saying, either there or here. What I tried to focus on, given my limited exposure to people inside Iran, except through Twitter and the videos that we're all watching, is on U.S. policy and this U.S. administration that had been trying to revive the nuclear deal. And really, the same time as Raisi came to New York in September, the nuclear talks were going nowhere. And this is a regime that seems incapable of deciding what they want to do. They've gotten close twice in the past year to a draft deal. And then the negotiators go back to Tehran and a few weeks go by and their bosses don't give the okay or put up some new demand. that they know that the West can't accept. And it's interesting that there's a kind of paralysis on the Iranian side on going forward with the nuclear deal. And I think it's similar to the kind of paralysis we see in their lack of certainty of how to respond to the protests. And so for the U.S. policymakers trying to figure out what to do, they were already going to have to figure out in the next few weeks, the next few months, what are we going to do if we're not going to get a nuclear deal? And I think in a way, the fact that there's no nuclear deal to try to get through Congress to have to sign off on, you know, they can lean into the protests more than we might have seen at earlier points. Because, you know, we've seen the U.S. administration from President Biden in a statement, Secretary of State Blinken, all the spokespeople for the White House and the State Department talk about how they admire these women and girls, that these people should have their rights. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, who was very involved in the nuclear negotiations for the Obama administration, spoke with technology companies to try to assure them of the loosening of sanctions so they can get technology to Iranian people so they can communicate better and protect themselves from surveillance. So without the U.S. trying to say we're backing regime change, they've tried to give their rhetorical support and through the use of sanctions, their support to the people on the streets.
Well, thanks for that, Laura, for all of your comments with respect to any kind of relationship with the nuclear deal. We certainly were not expecting these protests because we were concentrating on focusing on whether or not we were going to have a revived nuclear deal. But we'll have more on that in just a moment.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Iran. I'm Steve Miller, in for Michael Lippin. We resume the conversation between VOA Encounter host Carol Castiel with Laura Rosen and Alex Vatanka.
Well, back to you, Alex Vatanka. What is the relationship, if any, between the so-called nuclear deal that we were concentrating on for so many months over the past year, whether or not it was going to be revived? We've heard also criticism from activists in Iran who are saying that the U.S. had been too obsessed with the deal to the detriment of condemning Iran's egregious human rights abuses. What are your thoughts with regard to that?
Thanks, Carol. I mean, I think Laura did a great job pointing out the key issues here that we're sort of looking at as far as the state of the diplomatic process is concerned. But essentially, in the 2015 round, which resulted in the nuclear deal that year, the United States believed that a nuclear deal was necessary in its own right to stop Iran's nuclear program from expanding, but that it could also perhaps become a stepping stone to a broader dialogue with the Islamic Republic. So the United States could talk to the Iranian regime about other concerns, what Iran is doing in the region, its ballistic missile program, and so on and so forth. The first part of the equation worked. The Iranian nuclear program did not expand. In fact, it shrunk as it should have as part of the deal, but nothing else happened. And that's exactly why the Trump administration in 2018 was able to walk away from the deal, because it said, sure, the Obama administration believed that this could lead to something better and bigger in terms of the conversation, but Iran is not interested. And that is true. You can criticize the Trump administration for all sorts of reasons, but the fact is Ayatollah Khamenei, the Iranian supreme leader, has not really seriously for a long time been interested in that deeper, broader conversation with the United States. And that's where we are today. So basically, the Biden administration here has to make a decision. Is putting the brakes on Iran's nuclear program alone worth continuing the diplomatic track? Because as Laura just pointed out, it hasn't been easy. The demands on the other side has been shifting. I don't think the Iranian side doesn't have reason to want to negotiate a better deal from their perspective. But that's a side issue we can get to if we want. But the reality is Khamenei isn't interested in that broader conversation. And here is an Iranian supreme leader, age of 83, who basically is a political dinosaur. He does not represent the future of his own people. And anyone who watches Iran and the basic realities of that country and is advising the U.S. president will say, look, President Biden, you can invest in the country of Iran, the nation of Iran, the people of Iran, who are clearly fed up with the system that has been ruling over them since 1979. And by the way, this is a nation that by and large is pro-American, has no issues in terms of having a dialogue with the United States. And that's the people we should be investing in. And I think, again, to Laura's point about trying to find ways to help the Iranian protesters, that's where we are today. The alternative would be, and just imagine what this would mean. I mean, the optics of this for the Biden administration. The alternative is that as Iranian protesters are out there getting killed while fighting for their basic rights, months, the Biden administration decides to cut a new deal that they know before they cut that deal, it'll be a limited deal. It'll be limited to the number of centrifuges the Iranians would put away or how much they enrich their uranium to and so forth. But it wouldn't lead to anything bigger. It wouldn't lead to normal relations between the two countries because, as I said, Khamenei is not interested in that. So basically, Biden would be right before midterm elections, and presumably if he wants to seek re-election, he has to answer not just to the Iranian protesters, the American public, but also the globe that's looking. What is this American foreign policy that he says has a huge component in it called seeking to help people out there, promoting democracy? What is it really about in actual fact when it comes to making the hard decisions? If they're willing to cut a deal with a regime that clearly is out of touch with its own people, has nothing that's democratic about it. In fact, the opposite is true. It's repressive, and it's a militant Islamist ideology that hasn't just wrecked Iran, but is actually trying to export the same, in my view, horrendous ideology to neighboring countries in the Middle East. Why would you cut a deal with that regime right now, where you could alternatively find ways to empower the protesters, that vast majority of Iranian public opinion that wants a very different future? It's not an easy challenge. It's not an easy policy proposition, because the basic fact is, after Iraq, after Afghanistan, there is very little appetite in U.S. public opinion for anything that looks like experimenting with regime changes or nation building in that part of the world. So that's the balance for the Biden administration. How do they do something that would fit their own rhetoric in terms of what Biden foreign policy is about, not letting down the Iranian protesters, but at the same time, not getting themselves trapped in something that might be the beginning of another intervention in another Middle Eastern country, where, as I said, U.S. public opinion probably doesn't want to go there just because of recent two decades of bad experiences in places like Iraq and Afghanistan and so on.
Can I jump in, Carol?
Yeah, please do, Laura.
Alex, and I totally agree that that is the dilemma that the administration could find itself confronting if the Iranians do come back, as some people thought there might be a window after the U.S. midterms, and that the Iranians were aware of this political calendar in the United States. You know, they thought, well, maybe the Iranians will come back and have softened their demands on the IAEA probe. And then I think the administration will have a dilemma. I don't think the administration was ever confident that the Iranians were going to back off this demand, but that had previously been the one scenario. Let me just ask, though, for the voices that we're hearing, you're hearing from people in and out of Iran, some saying that it would be a betrayal of the protesters for the U.S. administration to cut a deal with this regime, as you say, both because it legitimates this regime and would give it more money, right? Letting them sell their oil around the world. What would be the effect on young people in Iran who want change, who want to maybe change the regime over time, if Iran becomes a threshold nuclear power or, against U.S. wishes, becomes a nuclear power? Would that empower the regime against its own people, not just against foreign enemies? Alex.
Right. No, I mean, that's an important question to ask. I would measure it first and foremost in terms of what it does to the psychology of those people who are part of the regime. I've been tracking Iranian domestic politics for 20 some years, and I think the sort of number of people who are supporting the regime in terms of percentage is about the 15%.
That low?
That low, I think 15%. And I think a good chunk of that is made up people who are basically getting their monthly salary from the regime. They're no longer necessarily believers in the system. I think the percentage of people who are diehard and still believe in the narrative Ayatollah Khamenei is significantly lower than 15%. But a lot of people are actually making a living from being associated with this regime. And that makes a difference in the sense that if you had people leaving the regime, that could be the beginning of the end of the regime. Defection is key here, right? Why are we so interested in following the prominent figures defecting? So far hasn't happened. Why are we so interested in the idea of general strikes? Because that would tell you that the tide is actually changing here. We haven't seen major strikes like we did in 78, 79 before the Shah's regime fell. But if you have an Iran that is, or could argue Iran already is a nuclear threshold country, but say it's consolidated in that position, what does it do to the psychology of such a big percentage of folks in the regime who are on the fence today? But if they feel that Iran, this regime, has been accepted by the world as a nuclear threshold state, I would guess that they are more likely to then stay with the regime as opposed to bomb ship.
I'm not saying that the world would accept it. I'm saying if there's no nuclear deal that rolls back Iran's nuclear program, if Iran gets closer and closer to having a nuclear weapon, it's pretty clear that they have enough fissile material for a few nuclear weapons in a few weeks, right? So I'm not saying that the world accepts it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I think I do. But look, if the question is, Laura,
what's the alternative way to prevent Iran from having a nuclear weapon? If you are Joe Biden or if you're the Israeli prime minister, do you see military action as being a viable thing? I don't.
I don't think anybody at this point really thinks that aerial strikes alone is going to end Iran's nuclear program. In terms of military option, presumably, and this is why nobody's taking that option seriously, you're talking about full-scale invasion and occupation of a country the size of Alaska of 85 million people. It's a huge undertaking. I see zero appetite for that sort of a mission here in the United States, less so among European allies. So that's why it's such a tough position to be in. The ramifications of military operation against this system that goes wrong could impact not just the issue of Iran, but entire Middle East could be impacted by it. Vast areas of U.S. interest could be impacted adversely if this goes wrong.
I just wanted to turn it back to the protests, because these are issues that are not mutually exclusive, reining in Iran's nuclear program, as well as trying to defend and help the protesters. So, Alex, just quickly, is this pretty broad, the protests? Are they across the entire nation? Are there specific geographic regions? I mean, would you say this pretty much extends to the wider population? What about the crackdowns? They seem to be focusing on minority groups like the Kurdish regions, maybe Sunni Muslims.
Right. So, Carol, if you go back to 1979 and onwards, you've seen protests against the regime many times over, starting the early 80s. But that's the big difference between then and today. Used to be limited to political groups that were fighting one another. Today, you're talking about broad parts of society coming out, not because of a particular political issue that they don't like, but because they don't like the way life has become in the Islamic Republic. It has become a dark place to live. Hopelessness is what basically is the order of the day. So many people essentially have nothing more to lose. The Islamic Republic has already produced one of the largest diasporas in recent memory. Millions of Iranians have left the country. Not everybody can leave. And those are the ones who are fighting. Now, in terms of where it's happening everywhere. Last time we had major protests back in 2009, it centered on Tehran. It centered with the middle classes. And they had a more or less a political fight with the regime in terms of an election outcome back then. But today, they're not fighting for a particular concession from the regime. They're asking the regime to go away. They want the end of the regime. And it's not limited to Tehran anymore. It's across the country.
Laura Rosen is a foreign policy journalist, and Alex Vitanka is the director of the Iran program at the Middle East Institute. They were speaking with VOA Encounter host Carol Castiel in October. Be sure to visit voanews.com and click on the Iran tab at the top of the page for additional updates on Iran throughout the day. And finally, Reuters' Rachel Farber shares with us a story about a dancer from Iran who chose to leave the country for fear of being jailed.
Mikhail Alizadeh used to give dance lessons in secret in Iran. She moved to Turkey in 2015 after receiving threats, fearing she'd be jailed for being a dancer. A neighbor had even reported her to the police. They accused her of being a prostitute. I had to make a choice, she says, between dancing or living in Iran. Now, she is hoping to use her voice from abroad for change in her home country. Alizadeh is one of hundreds of Iranians who have attended protests in Turkey, triggered by the death of Mahsa Amini.
We are going to win this time. This government is cruel. This government is a killer. Cruelty is not sustainable. Its end has come.
She and others are calling for the downfall of the Islamic Republic. Amini died in the custody of Iran's morality police after being detained for violating strict codes requiring women to dress modestly in public. The unrest in Iran and around the world has become one of the boldest challenges to Iran's rulers since the 1979 revolution.
Sometimes people say that if you are abroad, you cannot do anything, but that is not the case. Indeed, people in Iran have become very strong right now, and it's all because of that, thanks to our protests and support around the world, thanks to the support of women and men in Turkey. It really gives us strength and hope.
Rachel Farber of Reuters News. And that brings us to the end of this special presentation. There's, of course, more coverage of Iran 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, as well as on our social media platforms, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. I'm Steve Miller in Washington, and on behalf of the entire Flashpoint Iran team, thank you for listening.